Want to get an important message across but having trouble finding the right words? Wish your gift could express that special sentiment you feel for your partner, friend, coworker, family member, pet psychic, crossing guard, meth dealer, or boss? Now there's a way that your special message can go directly to your gift recipient without them even realizing it. Introducing Sublimatext, the gift card service that works on the subconscious level to let that special someone know exactly what they mean to you. For a flat fee of just $6.66, the Sublimatext service can be added to any Illumin Select gift order and delivered right to the recipient's door. Also available in audio form. Sublimatext is so seamlessly integrated into the consciousness of the recipient, I bet you didn't even realize that we put one right in this ad. P.S. The message is, I love you. And you'll love Sublimatext or your money back. See Illumin Industries Cyber Catalog for details.
Lux Occult is a part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
Sierra, Whiskey, Omega, Romeo.
Thou lambent spirit of air, thou hast kindled the sacred fire from dead ashes, so my torch lightens all darkness. Thou hast become the fulcrum of my will. Everlasting in thee, I know no respite. Except in the sensuous impact of flesh, there are no meanings. Thou hast awakened me unto eternities. Thou makest all things beautiful unto the grotesque. Whom thou succor hath no sterility. I am reborn and reborn into desirous becomings. I have recreated my soul by birthing pleasure. Through thee, my will, desire, belief, and word become the law that carries me into the catastrophic beyond becoming. Thou, the emissary of neither, ever silent watcher, thou hast shown me the new sexualities and all the mysteries of the threshold. Only thee I adore in my soul, an everlasting body. Alpha, Omega, Amen. That was the Prayer of Adoration from the first formula of Zos Vel Thanatos by Austin Osmond Spare. Hello and welcome to Lux Occult. It's the podcast where we gleefully taunt the mundane, butcher the Latin and most other languages, and we also discuss a variety of occult topics. I'm your host, Lux Estrada, and if you're hearing the sound of my voice, that means that this show and magic are for you, if you want them. There are a lot of different ways to be more free, and using magic or making space for a spiritual practice in your life can be one of them. As always, I don't speak for anyone but myself. Others can, will, and should disagree with me sometimes. How will we ever learn anything if we all agreed all the time, after all? And like anybody who tries to be reasonable should be willing to do, I am willing to revise my opinions based on new evidence. All right, happy Valentine's Day, or whenever you're listening to this. All kinds of fun topics to talk about here. I'm very stoked to share the conversation I had with Joel of Dream Mirror, who was kind enough to come back and talk more feedback worship with me, and reminisce about his year-long video ritual project, Desires in Motion, as well as talking about the Circle of Fifths, using ideals from alchemy and music, and all kinds of other interesting things. You can hear the first recursion of Joel and my musings on feedback worship in episode 15 of this show. All right, so this one today also features a poem by E.A. Tolles, which I am very stoked to share with you. Check out my conversation with him back in episode 14. And as a side note, anybody who does listen to that one and is offended, please note that the joke I made about the priest thing, it was done in ignorance, not in disrespect, so apologies there for any potential ruffled feathers. Anyway, EA's writing has always struck me as really sensual and honest, and I feel super honored that he was willing to share some of his stuff with me so that I could share it with all of you. That's going to be just before the bibliomancy break. All right, so before we dive in, I would like to say thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you taking the time to hang out with me here on the show, as always. Super stoked to have such amazing collaborators and listeners, etc. Fuck yeah, you guys rock. I've been using social media a lot less, as everybody knows. Perhaps they've heard me say it, I don't know. But that doesn't mean that I don't want to talk to people, so, you know, please don't hesitate to reach out with your thoughts, questions, comments, arcane revelations, suggestions, what have you. And you can get me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com or find me on Instagram at luxoccultpod. If you like the show and you're into what I'm doing, you can support it on Patreon. If you do so, you can take a bibliomancy break with me. There are no tiers or levels or whatever, so give as you will. And thank you so much to all of you who are already doing that. It's really awesome and I really appreciate it, and your support makes the show possible, so thank you so much. Okay, so later, after my conversation with Joel, we're going to talk about the tomato, or poisonous love apple, as it was sometimes called. I'm going to share some fun info about it and its magical uses and associations, however dubious my sources might be. We'll talk more about that later. Shout out to Outlaw Dharma for this suggestion. I fucking love it. Hell yeah, dude. Okay, so Joel has this cool piece on his blog called Mapping the Labyrinth of Light. That is an exploration of video feedback, much like what is discussed in Douglas Hofstadter's I Am a Strange Loop. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on. It's a pretty rad book. I'll share a little bit from it. Also, we'll hear a little bit from Ian McGilchrist, as well as some more from Austin Osmond's Fair. I'm also going to be sharing a little bit from Aidan Wachter's new book, Changeling, A Book of Qualities. It's a very interesting and very unique book about magic and navigating the world effectively. I had a great conversation with Aidan recently about Changeling and stepping into your power. Aidan was also kind enough to chat with me about inclusivity in magic and ways that he's worked with the Green Mushroom Project, and that's going to be part of the next audio grimoire episode. Both of those conversations are full of a lot of great insight, which I'm sure you probably won't be surprised to hear if you're familiar with Aidan's work. And there's really some interesting threads that connect this new book, Changeling, with Weaving Fate and stuff. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So hell yeah, all kinds of cool stuff coming down the line. Also stoked to share the dope conversation that I had with Eric J. Millar, creator of various very cool oracular devices and prolific artist and writer and, yes, creator of many cool things. So stoked to share that with you soon as well. Okay, so I mentioned the Green Mushroom Project audio grimoire a second ago, and I'm looking forward to recording more of that with some very fine folks soon. Actually, God's willing, by the time this comes out, we will have already recorded it. And I'm assuming it went very well. Knock on wood, of course. Shout out to Kate Crane. And much love to everybody participating in the project, no matter what that looks like for you in your individual practice. Okay, so setting the table here for the chat I had with Joel. The topic of cymatics comes up pretty early on, sort of in passing. I wanted to touch on it before we dive in, though, because it is interesting stuff. It's only tangentially related to what Joel does. While some of the Dream Mirror stuff touches on the concept of seeing music through electronic means, cymatics has to do with how physical sound waves can cause visible patterns to form in a medium, like sand. So it's a different thing, but there are some interesting conceptual intersections, I think. Okay, so here's from Wikipedia. Cymatics is a subset of modal vibrational phenomena. The term was coined by Hans Jenny, a Swiss follower of the philosophical school known as Anthroposophy. I think we've heard a little bit about those guys in previous episodes. Typically, the surface of a plate, diaphragm, or membrane is vibrated, and regions of maximum and minimum displacement are made visible in a thin coating of particles, paste, or liquid. Different patterns emerge in the excitatory medium depending on the geometry of the plate and the driving frequency. Okay, so there was a variety of different experiments carried out. The ones that are probably the most famous are the ones that were that perfected all this. Galileo messed around with it, and so did Robert Hooke, but this dude, Ernst Chladni, who was a German musician and physicist, did a lot of work on him, and he introduced them systematically in 1787 in his book Discoveries on the Theory of Sound. This provided an important contribution to the understanding of acoustic phenomena and the functioning of musical instruments. So the figures thus obtained, with the aid of a violin bow that rubbed perpendicularly along the edge of a smooth plate covered in sand, are still described by the name Chladni figures. Okay, cool. Thanks, Wikipedia. So if you check out these Chladni figures, some of them are reminiscent to what Joel's Dream Mirror produces, even though, as I mentioned earlier, they are derived in different ways in terms of, like, physics and stuff. But I wonder if there are some, like, obscure, or maybe, I don't know, perhaps not so obscure, I don't understand this shit very well, like, reasons that for their, like, symmetry to exist. I don't know. If you have any ideas about this, let me know. Okay, so another topic that we cover in today's conversation is an idea that Joel has about using concepts from alchemy in his work. Speaking of alchemy, don't miss last year's Valentine's Day episode, which I think is number 18, with author and creator of Love Chaos, Derek Hunter, who also likes to use concepts from alchemy in his work. Cheers to Lee Kirk, whose novella I Suffer Alchemy should be out any day now as I record this. So fuck yeah, shout out to you guys. All right, I will be back during a break to share a spicy bit of poetry that E.A. Tolles wrote, as well as providing various other literary tidbits and stuff. But first, let's get into it. Here is my conversation with Joel of Dream Mirror. All right, fuck yeah. Joel, thank you so much for coming back to talk with me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, I'm stoked that you're here. So maybe for people that haven't heard the last episode where you were here, like, just give like a little intro and sort of like, you know, let everybody know what you're about and everything.
I'm a person, I've been kind of heavily into sound and video art and for a long time, but in the last couple of years specifically, and over the last year, I was working on a project where I was making a piece of video and sound art every month with a magical intention, and that project kind of started around the same time that the Green Mushroom project started, and we're kind of in similar veins. Yeah, so then we had a conversation back then around a year ago talking about that stuff, and now I'm back.
Absolutely, yeah, and like a lot of your stuff has to do with feedback and stuff. The episode is called Feedback Worship and shit, and could you maybe just talk a little bit like philosophically about feedback and like what does that mean to you and like in terms of incorporating it within your work?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So like feedback in my experience, well, it's like a thing that happens that isn't, it's not like an instrument is designed to make a specific note, and feedback is something that just happens through that equipment, but has all sorts of subtlety to it, right? Because it's not a specific thing. It's not, the parameters that control it are, you know, in the space of, in sound, it's like the whole room or like the space that it's existing in. And then when you get into video, it gets really interesting because, well, there's just really interesting things that happen when you take video feedback and put it into very specific parameters and balance it. And you get these geometric things happening. And I guess to talk about that philosophically, it's like, sort of like exploring the energy patterns that exist at certain geometries and certain angles. And it's like, it's a very like mathematical thing, but you're handling it in such a non-computerized way, in such a hands-on way, where every little thing affects the thing that's happening, that it feels very alive and very responsive to like the most subtle influences.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So like for people that are trying to get a, like a mental image, like could you describe about like, you know, how does this, like if I were watching you like fuck around with this, like what would this equipment look like and stuff?
Yeah, so you would walk into a room that was dimly lit and there would be basically a table that's glowing with moving light patterns on it. And you'd be like, what is that? And I would explain that it's a television facing up inside a table with a camera above it, suspended over it, looking down. And then that camera is like held on an arm that's on this ring around the circle cutout going into the screen. And you can put your hands on that ring and twist it. And then that changes all the images that you're seeing shift and turn. If you turn that ring or if you put your hand across it, you see an echo of the image of your hand repeating in all these different positions. So there's this live portal where the camera sees what the camera sees is projected on the screen, and then the camera is looking into itself. So the images are repeated in this repeating pattern, and then each change in angle or each change in whatever changes happen, they repeat like an echo into infinity.
Okay. Last time you were here, we talked a little bit about how you'll use like, instead of putting like sound input, you'll put like sound input into a visual port or something. And I think it's interesting to think about the way that you use technology, like sort of, as you said, to explore these like hidden patterns, like you're sort of constructing this like device for seeing these things that you wouldn't normally see.
Yeah. People often bring that up. It is interesting because I'm kind of like messing around in weird ways of using things in ways they were never really intended to be created. And yeah, I have like a way of plugging the audio channel into a video signal on like a certain monitor I have, and it like gives me direct punches of signal, right? And those mix with the feedback. So you get like all these really interesting interactions, and it's very much like the magic is in kind of like dialing those in and like getting these really subtle things to happen through those interactions. And I don't know if it's an exact simulation of cymatics necessarily, but it's something like that.
Fuck yeah. So you had mentioned the like long ritual desires in motion. That's the correct name of it, right?
Yeah, I like that name for it.
Okay, fuck yeah. I mean, so yeah, this was like this really ambitious project that you took on, and it was just really dope to see it unfold. And you were telling me before we started recording that you were just now uploading the last video, so I'm super stoked to see it.
Yeah, no, it's really cool to come back and talk about that, because we talked, I think, after I just finished the second piece. And yeah, and like the whole piece, like as I started, was somewhat inspired by the Green Mushroom Project, and like I had that sigil in the first piece, and then in the last piece that I just finished uploading, I sort of returned to a lot of the themes in the first video, both like musically and visually, and like sort of was trying to tie the thing together. But yeah, it's interesting to look back, you know, when you set out to do something and you're not exactly sure what it is, to like see how it evolved and what you got out of it and look at it, especially as like a magical thing, like to see kind of, you know, I don't know, was this successful, or is that even really, I don't know if that's a valid question exactly.
I mean, it depends on what what your parameters were for success, I guess, right? Like, I mean, just the idea of just like carrying it out at all I felt like it was like a pretty ambitious. It seemed like to me, at least, and I don't know. It's dope to see it. To see it being carried out like there. I was wondering if you had any advice for people who have a sort of like an itch to do something that is kind of like ambitious that might require like kind of long-term, you know, digging your heels in, what advice would you offer to folks that are looking to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Cause that's kind of what this was for me. It's like, I was like, I need a way to like keep myself producing something consistently. I guess I would say, I mean, it's about making it a practice. And I think, I mean, for me, like figuring out the right timing, like having a goal of like getting this thing done every month, like that was doable enough for me. Like if I had like, you know, said I'm going to do something every day, like I don't think I would have done it. I guess so. It's like figuring out your own timing of like what's realistic for you. And for me, it being I'm going to complete this thing, one of these every month, was doable because it was like I would spend, some of them I would spend a lot of time kind of thinking about and working on and like recording the music to. And then like in the days leading up to the full moon, I'd have to like be like, oh, I'm getting myself ready. I'm getting all the pieces together to like record the final video part of it. So it became like a, I don't know, interesting like challenge and like a process that I had a degree of flexibility. I had a lot of flexibility in it. You know, some of them were recorded in one session. Some of them were like weeks in the making. And then there were a few where I happened to be, you know, far away from my laboratory and like off in the woods and just like recorded something with my cell phone that contained the core ingredients.
Which was still dope, actually. That was like one of my favorite ones. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because like, yeah, that's also, that's like, it's straight up, you were straight up like literally doing magic and that was what the video ritual was. And like, it was, yeah, it was very literal and I liked it.
Yeah. And it's interesting looking back at it because like those moments are kind of my favorite because it was like, oh, I have to like figure out like how this works in this setting, like without all the stuff I normally use, you know, like. I still have all the same ingredients. I have sound, visual, like intention and abstraction, you know, like, so yeah, you can break it down and make it simpler than it can. I don't know. It's good to have a process that can be really complicated or can become really simple, I guess, realizing it doesn't, that it's all kind of the same.
Fuck yeah. So I'm wondering, just, do you have any like sort of sum up takeaway experience from like doing something like this and carrying it out? Do you have like a sort of, in a nutshell, like looking back on it, what would the catchphrase be that you would assign to something like this? If that's a relevant question, I'm not sure. It might be a little too reductive.
I'm not sure if I know how to answer that exactly, but I guess like, you know, it became a very much like, I have this thing I'm doing and I have to make special sacred time for myself to be in this like environment. And, you know, if I hadn't like made that intention, like I'm going to do it like this, then I probably wouldn't have made that type of environment for myself and that type of time for myself to like be in that magical environment. So yeah, it really was, I guess it's a process of like making sacred time and space for yourself. I guess that's like kind of mostly what I take away from it.
It sounds like a big part of that was like having the willingness to commit to making that like a priority, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I'm super excited to talk about music and alchemy. So this is from your blog, I guess is the right word.
Yeah, I guess so. Live journal. I don't know.
Personal place where you post your writings, whatever. I don't know. There's so many names these days.
I mean, I just started it because I needed to get these things up there somehow. So I don't know exactly how it'll operate, if I'll figure out a way to churn out more material regularly or not. But yeah.
Well, there's definitely some dope shit on here, so I'm enjoying it. All right, so, and you do note here that this, like, kind of, this sort of project investigating alchemy and music is ongoing, but do you want to give, like, a little bit of an introduction to this concept and how you came upon it?
Yeah, I guess I've been sort of, wanting to write things and capture thoughts that I feel are like practical and like useful. So I've been trying to do that. I've been engaging with like a sort of traditional pentagram ritual a lot over the last couple years. And so I've sort of been thinking about a lot of things in kind of traditional elemental ways. And I guess that led me to thinking about the way I think about music in that terminology. And I hadn't really seen anybody else structured exactly the way I kind of came to think of it. So I wanted to write a little something about that. And it's pretty basic, but I just essentially started categorizing the element of air as like all the things that are intellectual and mental about music, and fire as all things that are sort of texture and timbre and like sort of tonal quality and energy, and water as being the emotional side, that being like notes and melody and how tones relate to each other to create emotion, and then earth being all things having to do with rhythm and tempo and percussion. And I guess just sort of dividing up the material into these different elements has been helpful, or practical maybe.
Hell yeah. So in terms of like thinking about this, because I don't know, we didn't mention this yet, but you are a musician as well, which might be obvious based on what you just said. So have you been playing with this in terms of like putting it into play in your musical practice?
Yeah, I mean, mainly it's been kind of a way I think about things. So if I'm trying to create, a lot of times I'll sort of approach creating a piece of music from the perspective of like the idea first, and like, what is it I'm after? What like thing am I trying to create? Right. Like, and a lot of times the dream mirrors like are a good example of that, because some of them are really intense and some of them are more ambient, and like, you know, it starts out with like the statement of intention and like, what is it I'm trying to express here? And then I'll sort of focus in on certain elements, you know, like for example, like ritual 3 is like totally chaotic and like discordant and just super noisy. So like that one's super like of a fire oriented thing. So a lot of times I'll just sort of think about, I guess, the intention of what I'm trying to make and like focus on the abstract like idea of what I'm after, and then focus on that element, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe like a person would do when they're sort of constructing like a ritual, if this is how they work, like, you know, putting these mm-hmm. elements together and like, because it goes together, or, you know, yeah, that makes sense. So I see here that you have made some notes about some of like the music theory behind some of this stuff. Do you mind if we go into things like the circle of fifths?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so what is the circle of fifths?
It's this cool circle.
Is it as cool as the unit circle in trigonometry?
I can't tell you. Question for somebody else. But it's like a, it's sort of a map of how things work a little bit. Because like, if you're looking at a keyboard, there's essentially like 7 whole steps and then it repeats. And, you know, the way chord structure works is like each one of those is a place where like a chord could be. And the circle of fifths sort of shows you, you know, if you jumped from A, if you jumped up 5 steps, you'd be at E. And then if you jumped up 5 steps from there, you'd be at B. So it like shows you these all next to each other.
Okay, and so like when you're constructing a chord, going 5 steps is like what sounds good to us.
It's one of the major common steps, right? It's like in most folk songs, there's only a few different things that happen usually. You know, they usually have like 3 or maybe 4 chords, and they're usually close to each other on the circle of fifths. They're usually right next to each other. Like, you know, you'd have a song that's C, G, and F. And, you know, you'd have a song that's A, D, and E. And it's yeah, it's kind of a map of how like how things that are tried and true are like right there.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. So yeah, this is like maybe like a flavor wheel, if you will. Like I don't know if you've seen those like for like cooking. It's like these are the spices that taste good together or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm very ignorant about music, so thank you so much for explaining. Super interesting.
It's okay. It's cool to to have it in front of you and play with it and like try out weird combinations that are like maybe less obvious. You know, I've been playing a little bit around experimenting with like, oh, what if I just like put certain shapes like over imposed on this? Like, is there some logic to that or, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like use it like a chamier or something for yeah. constructing a sigil or yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool.
Like you've been playing with like, oh, can I make a song out of a unicursal hexagram on top of this? You know, like, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Maybe it does. You know,
maybe. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I love it. How would you feel about taking a bibliomancy break?
Sure.
Hey, what's up? It's me, Luxa from the future. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. We're going to be getting to that bibliomancy break in a little bit here, as well as some poetry by E.A. Tolles. But first, I'd like to say thank you so much for listening. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Lupercalia, which is perhaps the much more metal root of the mid-February holiday. And I know that this can be kind of a rough one for folks, probably because of all the silly pressure surrounding the holiday or pseudo-holiday or whatever, depending on who you are and who you ask. And where you live, I know this isn't like a thing everywhere. There seems to be this sort of like pervasive misconception, though, in like a lot of cultures about love and relationships. We see all these narratives that seem to be saying that once you find somebody to have a romantic partnership with, all of your problems will just disappear happily ever after, you know? I feel like it's actually probably the opposite. Like a close relationship, at least a healthy one, requires a lot of effort and maintenance. Like any fucking thing else, right? Like entropy is a thing. Anyway, it's work, right? Oftentimes it's work worth doing. But I feel like that's not really something that is portrayed a lot of times in the media and stuff. It just seems like there's a lot of like popular love stories and songs and shit about, you know, being in turmoil due to like, I don't know, non-secure attachment styles or poor communication or whatever. I don't know. There's all kinds of like what I would call maybe like fucked up templates out there. And I get that, like, to tell an interesting story, there needs to be conflict and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. And I'm not trying to, like, say all this to imply that I have my shit all figured out or whatever, because I can assure you nothing could be further from the truth, but like most people, I am working on it. I just say this to, like, point out that if your life doesn't fit into the model of what is being shown on, like, TV or in the movies or whatever, wherever you live, like, maybe that's okay. Like, maybe it's okay to feel different. You know, in fact, like, maybe it's actually a good thing for you in the long run, just from the standpoint of not falling into, like, these toxic traps that many seem to succumb to. I could go on, but speaking of toxic traps, I'd like to just quickly address, real quick, the gross consumerism that surrounds this and, well, pretty much all mainstream US holidays. I'm guessing this is a thing in other places too, but I don't really have the context to speak to that. But when it comes to Valentine's Day or whatever, like, I don't know, don't get me wrong, I enjoy eating chocolate as much as the next person, like, as long as it's good. But, you know, and flowers are cool or whatever. But it seems like holidays have become a sort of, like, control mechanism for driving consumer purchasing. It's like we're all on this, like, buying schedule or whatever. I don't know, I'm guessing that that's probably at least partly by design. We're probably going to be talking about this more in the future, or something adjacent at least. Anyway, getting back to what I was saying before, maybe we don't feel like, you know, doing the whole cards and candles and candies thing, you know, or whatever people are doing. There are a lot of ways to celebrate. Like, so the history of where Valentine's Day is thought to have come from is pretty interesting. A quick word here though, the story I'm about to tell you has animal sacrifice in it. And one of the animals is a kind of animal that people keep as pets a lot. So if you think that that might be uncomfortable or make you sad, please just like skip ahead about 45 seconds. I don't want to like fuck up anybody's day or anything. Okay, so let's start with Britannica. Just a quick definition of what Valentine's Day is. So Valentine's Day, or St. Valentine's Day, is a holiday on February 14th when lovers express their affection with greetings and gifts. Given their similarities, it has been suggested that this holiday has origins in the Roman festival of Lupercalia, which was held in mid-February. The festival, which celebrated the coming of spring, included fertility rites and the pairing off of women with men by lottery. At the end of the 15th century, Pope Gelasius I forbid the celebration of Lupercalia, and it is sometimes attributed with replacing it with St. Valentine's Day. But the true origin of the holiday is vague at best. Valentine's Day did not come to be celebrated as a day of romance until about the 14th century. So thanks, Britannica. So I'm actually given to understand that our modern conception of romance is like pretty different than most historical ones. I'm not quite sure how far back that goes, but I think I heard sort of somewhere around then. So that's interesting. All right. So the Romans were wild. You can hear more about that on Ad Hoc History. Let's check out Lupercalia. Lupercalia was a pastoral festival of ancient Rome, observed annually on February 15th to purify the city, promoting health and fertility. Lupercalia was known as Dies Feberatus, after the purification instruments called Februa, which was the basis for the month name Februaris, which became February, you probably figured out. Anyway, the rites were confined to the Lupercal Cave, the Palatine Hill, and the Forum, all of which were central location in Rome's foundation myth. Near the cave stood a sanctuary of Ruminia, goddess of breastfeeding, and the wild fig tree, Figus Ruminalis, to which Romus and Remus were brought by the divine intervention of the river god Tiburnius. Some Roman sources name the wild fig tree Camprificus, literally goat fig. Like the cultivated fig, its fruit is pendulous, and the tree exudes a milky sap if cut, which makes it a good candidate for a cult of breastfeeding. The Lupercalia had its own priesthood, the Luperci, or Brothers of the Wolf. At the Lupercal altar, a male goat or goats and a dog were sacrificed by one or another of the Luperci under the supervision of the chief priest of Jupiter. An offering was also made of salted meal cakes prepared by the Vestal Virgins. After the blood sacrifice, two Luperci approached the altar. Their foreheads were anointed with blood from the sacrificial knife, then wiped clean with wool soaked in milk, after which they were expected to laugh. The sacrificial feast followed, after which the Luperci cut thongs, known as Februa, from the flayed skin of the animal, and ran with these, naked or near naked, along the Palatine boundary, in an anti-clockwise direction around the hill. In Plutarch's description of the Lupercalia, written during the early empire, it says, "Many of the noble youths and the magistrates run up and down through the city naked, for sport and laughter, striking those they meet with shaggy thongs. And many women of rank also purposely get in their way, and like children at school present their hands to be struck, believing that the pregnant will thus be helped in delivery and the barren to pregnancy." So the Luperci completed their circuit around the Palatine, and then they returned to the Lupercal Cave. So that was the rites there. Okay, thank you, Wikipedia. Okay, that's, I don't know how I feel about the animal sacrifice thing. They do eat the animal, so, I mean, it's not like they're just, like, killing it for no reason. I mean, I don't know. It's a complicated issue, obviously. But in general, I think that when it comes to celebrating holidays, I think I would rather go, like, Lupercalian over Valentinian. Just saying. Okay, well, I would love to hear your thoughts about that. You can hit me up at luxocultpod@gmail.com or find me on Instagram at luxocultpod. All right, we're going to be getting to that bibliomancy break, and then I'll be back to tell you about more cool stuff. But first, as promised, here is a poem by E.A. Tolles. What's held in a morning breath? It begins with a breath, yours from behind a blanket, wrapped around your head. I listen, I inhale your escaped dreams, hold them in my chest, dreading the moment you stretch before turning away in bed. Mornings are meant to love, and aching joints and choked secrets and elbows drifting from each other's as if blades caught in a tense ballet. Do you love my scent? Does it hang around your neck? Does it suffocate? Or do you rinse me off with shower to skip down the drain with work, worries, and other tiny echoes? I rest on your knees because they are knobby, and the hair on your shins tickled my cheek. From here, the redolence of your cunt is a comfort. I sleep between your prickly thighs, drunk and swollen as Elohim's satisfaction on a restful day, waiting for you to slip from your dreams, those which only minutes ago I sucked from the hot exhale of your breath, this breath which cradles me while I count the minutes before another alarm rings and you turn and notice me, my arms thrown around you much as ecstatics grasping for their snakes and prophets, I shut tight against the glory of life and death. We are all too fragile to hold a sunrise. We cannot even meet the sun's own gaze. So I content myself to your breath, inhaled incense of your flesh, reminding myself much as the sun comes with each day, so you will also soon be awake. All right, fuck yeah. Thank you so much, EA Tolls, for sharing that. There will be links to his stuff in the show notes. And now, let's get to that bibliomancy break. Let's see. Do you have a D4 and a D8?
I do not have those.
I have those right here, so that is no problem. Okay, so go ahead and ask your question.
All right. My question is, what can I do to optimize my chances of winning a certain economic opportunity that is in my potential?
Okay. All right. It's going to be from The Myth of Sisyphus by Albert Camus. No errors. What can Joel do to optimize his probability of gaining the economic opportunity he seeks to gain? In Dostoevsky's novels, the question is propounded with such intensity that it can only invite extreme solutions. Existence is illusory, or it is eternal. All right, thank you.
All right, well, I need some extreme solutions now.
Yeah, it can only invite extreme solutions. All right, well, I hope that's helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you have any thoughts about divination or anything like that that you would like to share?
Yeah, I don't know. I realize I'm somebody who, like, if flip a coin for something, I inherently want to do the opposite of what it tells me.
For me, dude, the point of flipping the coin is so I can be clear about what I want, right? Like,
yeah,
I hear you.
So I realize there is like this aspect of myself that's like resistant to certain, I guess, maybe traditional forms of divination. But then there's often like things that if I get into things, I do feel like I can discern things. I don't know. I guess a lot of times I feel like I'm seeing things that make sense, but I'm resistant to doing what they tell me to do.
Yeah, I think that's a normal thing. Actually, I don't know.
Yeah.
I've been there for sure.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I guess I need to get better at accepting things or really like deciding to put weight on something random.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. It just really depends on how you look at it, right? Like, I don't know. I feel like it can be that way. You can look at it as just being, a psychological tool. I sometimes think about this, like, you know, we have all this information, but it's hard to parse it all out. And so using these tools can be a way of doing that. And I'm not saying that that's what's actually happening. I'm not making any ontological assertions or anything like that, but like I think sometimes it makes sense to think about it that way. It's a comfortable way to think about it for me, I guess, is another way of saying it.
Yeah, totally.
Hey, what's up? It's me again, Luxa from the future. Thanks for listening. I hope you're enjoying the episode. I know I had a great time talking with Joel. After the interview, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the magical uses of tomatoes and much more. But since it's related to what Joel and I are about to discuss, I wanted to share a passage from I Am a Strange Loop by Douglas Hofstetter, which I really love with all of you. It's one of those books that straddles a few different perspectives, and while it's not exactly about magic per se, I found it very magically useful. Shout out to the Faithblind Council podcast Discord server Book Club, where I enjoyed reading this book with all of you, and looking forward to more dope conversations about philosophy and magic and what have you. Okay, so what I'm about to read to you is written from the perspective of a scientific materialist, so just keep that in mind. Okay, so it starts out sort of talking about how the self is a sort of pattern, like our conception of ourself is a pattern. So that's the context here for what I'm about to read you. If there ever were, in our physics-governed world, a kind of magic, it is surely in these self-reflecting, self-defining patterns. Such strange loops, inspired by Gödel's Trojan horse that sneaked self-consciousness inside the very fortress that was built to keep it out, and recalling Roger Sperry's tower of forces within forces within forces, found inside each teetering bulb of dread and dream, give the only explanation I can fancy for how animate, desire-driven beings can arise from just plain matter, and for how, among the swarm of loops that populate our planet, there is one, and only one, that I call I, and I call you. You and I are mirages who perceive themselves, and the sole magical machinery behind these scenes is perception, the triggering, by huge flows of raw data, of a tiny set of symbols that stand for abstract regularities in the world. When perception at arbitrarily high levels of abstraction enters the world of physics, and when feedback loops galore come into play, then which eventually turns into who? What would once have been brusquely labeled as mechanical and reflexively discarded as a candidate for consciousness has to be reconsidered. We human beings are macroscopic structures in a universe whose laws reside at a microscopic level. As survival-seeking beings, we are driven to seek efficient explanations that make references only to entities at our own level. We therefore draw conceptual boundaries around entities that we easily perceive, and in so doing, we carve out what seems to be our reality. The I we create for each of us is a quintessential example of such a perceived or invented reality, and it does such a good job of explaining our behavior that it becomes the hub around which the rest of the world seems to rotate. But this I notion is just a shorthand for a vast mass of seething and churning of which we are necessarily unaware. We live in a state of blessed ignorance, but is also a state of marvelous enlightenment, for it involves floating in a universe of mid-level categories of our own creation, categories that function incredibly well as survival enhancers. In the end, we self-perceiving, self-inventing, locked-in mirages are little miracles of self-reference. Poised midway between the unvisualizable cosmic vastness of curved space-time and the dubious shadowy flickerings of charged quanta, we human beings, more like rainbows and mirages than like raindrops or boulders, are unpredictable, self-writing poems, vague, metaphorical, ambiguous, and sometimes exceedingly beautiful. Okay, fuck yeah. So this book is about how a person's self, or I-ness, or whatever you want to call it, can be said to exist in a non-localized and perhaps diffuse manner. I think Hofstetter might say that just from hearing me read a little bit from this book, a tiny bit of him, his consciousness or whatever, and also mine since I'm reading it, became introduced into the feedback loop that is your own experience. And there are these beautiful, and I think sort of like romantic implications about what that might mean, like the ways that we're all connected in this sort of like semiotic web of our perceptions and conceptions of each other. And this occurs on multiple levels, of course. But I will think more about that later, and I'll be back to read more to you from other books that I love, as well as sharing a few thoughts about sex magic and some stuff about my new album. But now let's dive back into that conversation with Joel. All right, fuck yeah. Well, let's talk about another thing that people can find on the Antares Transmission. Oh, sorry, it's Antares Transmission at WordPress.com. And this is Mapping the Labyrinth of Light, which is super dope. And definitely reminds me of a very cool book called I Am a Strange Loop by Douglas Hofstetter. So yeah, can we talk about this like video feedback loop?
Yeah, so that piece, this was a little zine I made when I like did sort of my first installation, like with this setup. Yeah, I kind of got my thoughts together, and this is what came out to explain what I was doing. So it's a real quick like rundown about how video feedback works, and then how I think about it, and how I kind of sort of put it into some sort of magical language a little bit. Yeah, glad you liked it. And
so I'm curious here, like you've noted like the different degrees around this pentagram and the traditional placements of like where the elements would be. Have you incorporated this, you know, like the sort of like numbers into any of the like musical alchemy stuff yet?
Sort of. Yeah, a little bit. Like, so, I mean, with the feedback thing, right, like you have a circle and then like there's all these different points that will make different stars. You know, you line it up at 27 degrees and you get a pentagram, but you line it up at 144 and you get a pentagram that where an image jumps a further distance instead of jumping, something doesn't jump from one point to the next point, it skips over. And like musically, I guess I have tried to think about the intersection a lot when I've recorded a lot of these pieces. And I guess I've made some pieces where I was sort of like symbolically like drawing a symbol with the notes that I played. So I've played a little bit with that, but yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly how to speak on the intersection between those concepts and music and visual.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's pretty out there abstraction for sure. I really like what you've written here about color too. Like this interesting, like, I don't know, I almost sort of get like a mercurial vibe from what you've written about like how it behaves. Like it's sort of, it's tricksy and it has a sort of trickstery vibe to it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That was my relationship to it at the time. And it's still kind of that way. It's yeah, it's weird. It's weird stuff.
Or maybe it's just our perception that's trickstery. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess they're not mutually exclusive. But yeah. I don't know. Can we actually, philosophically, I'm not sure if we can say that there's color without our perception. Anyway, nobody at me or send me an angry email, please. But yes. So I wanted to ask you about a song that I definitely was and probably still am like pretty like low key obsessed with, which is one of the things that you produced from this, you know, video rituals. And this is a song like So We May Shape All Things. And I was wondering if you'd ever thought about, you know, going back and like maybe like remastering it or like re-recording it and like doing something with it. Because I think it's a really cool song. And like, I think that you should put it out there because it's super dope.
Totally. Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, I was actually just like looking at that video recently and like, yeah, I should re-record that from the ground.
I love the video. Like the video, well, like it works with the video, right? It makes sense. It's like there's an ambiance, like it all makes sense. But the song, you know, if you re-recorded it, I think it could like let it shine a little bit more, right?
Oh,
like,
totally.
Yeah, totally. It's fucking, yeah, it's rad.
Yeah. And that's a thing I guess I'm sort of realizing too, is that like, I do need to return to things and re-examine them and re-articulate through ideas, I guess. But yeah, no, I appreciate that. Yeah, that song, like, you know, like I said, that was the second video piece, and there was a lot of, you know, intention put into that around it being something that kind of would hopefully have some subtle inspiration to the right people.
Yeah, no, it was powerful shit, man. Yeah, very cool. So, all right, I was going to ask you, you've done like a lot of work where you are like videotaping yourself in sort of ritual context. I haven't done a lot of this before, and I am preparing to do it soon for a project that I'm working on. What advice would you offer me as I prepare to embark on my own video ritual journey?
Ooh, well, that's a good question. I mean, I guess it's obviously kind of depends on the nature of what you're doing, but you kind of need a space that's uninterrupted. It is kind of tricky when you're doing things by yourself in some regards. So, I mean, I only really film myself physically for a couple of them.
Okay, cool. So you have an assistant usually?
No. I just like put a camera on a tripod and...
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Totally. Yeah, I'll I'm going to use a camera with a tripod too. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird thing to do. I don't really know if I would like working with an assistant more or less. Probably less, because I think I just like getting in the weird zone, you know?
Yeah, I think it would depend on who the assistant was. So, yeah. I could see that. Yeah. Like, vast majority of my work is alone. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's like, you know, get a screen facing you so you can see what you're doing, and then get some lighting that's under your control. And sometimes like you don't need a whole lot. You just need some space that you can control and some lighting you can control. See what happens, you know?
Hell yeah. So you're saying like, I like what you're saying, like about like, you know, watching the monitor, like as you're recording, because that is another feedback loop that's present, like mm-hmm. as this recording is happening. So that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's anything that's much different about like, is there a different feel when you're recording a ritual rather than just conducting it without recording for you? I'm not saying in general, just for you.
Well, for me, I mean, the way this project worked, it's like I can spend like infinite amount of time like in my equipment, practicing things, playing things, you know, making music, making visual stuff, just playing with it and getting things tuned. But then for me, the pressing the record button like was kind of like what really set it aside as like, this is a ritual now.
Okay.
Because it's like I spend a lot of time playing with the things and getting them ready and then being like, okay, everything's set up and now what happens and I'm like gonna accept it, you know?
Yeah, that makes total sense. Absolutely.
Yeah, so like that, getting ready to press that record button, and then when I press that record button, it's like, okay, this is being captured, and I'm like, yeah, doing my best, but like, you know, there, yeah, that's that sort of like changes it.
That makes sense. Yeah, in some ways, like, you know, for some rituals, there would be, I don't know, lighting the candle or whatever that sort of signals mm-hmm. that this is the beginning of this ritual. And
yeah,
hitting record makes total sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you up to now?
What am I up to now? I just bought a bus and I'm working on like getting that set up to like sort of live and travel in a little bit. So
that's fucking rad. Hell yeah.
Trying to like get prepared for like my next sort of stage of me taking some of this stuff on the road and like doing some work in some other locations.
That's super rad. So you're gonna be an eccentric dude that lives in a bus and like drives around with his weird like magic art show?
I've been that dude before and I will okay. be him again. Yeah,
go here for it.
Got a spot out in the woods where I've been like hanging up all kinds of giant bells from trees and working on sort of a long-term like sound installation piece of land. It's So, like, that's pretty cool, too.
Fuck yeah. So how do you see that kind of playing out?
It's just kind of a lifelong project, I guess, of just...
Okay. Just, you know, hanging stuff out in the woods.
Hanging things up from trees and, making a little forest sound installation.
That's dope. Yeah, it's like it's... you're turning this forest into a sort of instrument or a, I don't know, orchestra or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Hoping to do a little bit of traveling a little bit soon, working on that, playing music. Yeah, I don't know. A lot of unknowns, I guess, out there floating around, but trying to stay focused and motivated nonetheless.
Yes, as are we all, for sure. Well, hey, I appreciate you coming and talking with me again. Do you have any questions that you want to ask me before I let you go?
Well, I'm excited to hear what you're working on and how your project continues to develop and unfold.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've been enjoying it. Yeah, it's been a cool project. It's, I don't know, I'm very ignorant about music, but that doesn't stop me from fucking around with it. So
that's great. Yes. That's great.
All right, dude. Well, fuck yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate, as I said, you taking the time. And for people that are curious about your stuff, where can they find your video rituals and your writings and drawings and what have you?
So it's Dream Mirrors on Instagram, and kind of like everything has different names in different places.
Get yourself a link tree.
Yeah, I just made one, so.
Okay, cool. Well, there will be a link to your link tree in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah, go link it up.
Get linked.
Get linked. Get a link. Have a link. Yeah, it's awesome. Thanks so much for having me on again. It's a wonderful thing to be here.
All right, fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Joel. Always a pleasure. I considered playing the song that we were talking about in the episode, So We May Shape All Things, but since it's already in the first one that Joel joined me for, I decided not to. His work is deeply cool. Definitely check out his writing and his video ritual stuff. As you probably heard, there will be links to that in the show notes. So, kind of keeping in today's theme of, like, feedback loops and Valentine's Day and all that stuff, like, you know, to think of this kind of idea of, like, cycles and circles and roundness, you know, like, even the symbols that we associate with a lot of, you know, fertility things are round. I'm thinking about, like, eggs and apples and... I don't know, butts or whatever. So I wanted to share a little bit about this idea of roundness from a book by Ian McGilchrist called The Master and His Emissary. This is a pretty cool read for sure if you like philosophy and neuroscience. And yeah, it's a cool read. Definitely very interesting. So this is sort of about seeing circles in a lot of different places. The images of movement within stasis and of stasis within movement are reflected in the circle, as they are in the movement of water, ever flowing and ever the same, and in the stars that circle and always return. Dante sees this movement as the result of the gravitational effect of love, love that moves the sun and the other stars. To Shakespeare, this movement is also the movement of human life. Our little life is rounded with a sleep. Sir Walter Raleigh speaks of his love occupying a position in his mind, Yevon as the center in each parfait round. To Donne, his love for his mistress means that when he is away from her, he moves so that he is always in conjunction with her, never more distant, but like the arm of a compass circling its center point. For Donne, the love of God, too, meant that the created world circled the divine being. God himself, who had that omnisufficiency in himself, conceived a conveniency for his glory, to draw a circumference about the center, creatures about himself. I have mentioned Blake's reason is the bound or outward circumference of energy before. It suggests not just the idea that energy, the vital force of life, is like a sphere, but that reason is always just on the outside, never on the inside, always approximating, however nearly, the circumference, with even more tangents. Shelley speaks of the phenomenological world as a sphere, the devotion to something afar, from the sphere of our sorrow. The idea of the roundness of the phenomenological world is in some of Wordsworth's most famous and most mysteriously pregnant lines, "The round earth and the living air, rolled round in earth's diurnal course." Phrases which convey much more than the banal fact that earth is a sphere and it rotates. Van Gogh went so far as to say that life is probably round. All right, fuck yeah. Well, this is a cool book, as I said. Thanks, Ian McGilchrist. Do you know what else is round? Tomatoes, which we will be talking about here in just a second, as well as hearing a bit more about what I think might be fair to categorize as, I don't know, alchemical transmutation, perhaps. We'll hear from Austin Usman-Spare. I will read from the synopsis that I wrote about the Sound and Sex and Identity project I've been working on, and I think I'll play a sample from that too. I'm also going to read you a little bit from Aidan Wachter's new book, which I'm stoked to share. Very cool stuff there. Also very cool stuff, don't forget to check out all the other great shows on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. We've got Administrism, Ad Hoc History, Faithblind Council Podcast, Unearthing Paranormalcy, and Smuts Up. And we are very stoked to be welcoming some new shows here coming up in the very near future. We're going to be making these official announcements. In the meantime, I do want to give a big shout out to Flood from the XV Planis podcast. Definitely check his stuff out. He's really been hitting it hard with a lot of on-the-ground investigations of these paranormal sites. And he's also had some really great guests, me being one of them, I guess. But yeah, it's a great show. And if you're into paranormal spooky shit, definitely give it a listen. And speaking of paranormal spooky shit, don't miss Unearthing Paranormalcy. They just released a very fun and very cringy Valentine's Day episode about teratophilia, which is the love for unconventional looking people, I think would be a way to say it. And also, like, you know, just straight up like cryptids and stuff. Like, you know, if you're into Bigfoot or if you're like, you know, into Mothman or whatever, like that's teratophilia. So definitely check that out if you are interested in that. And you can also hear some of the crew of Unearthing Paranormalcy join Smuts Up for a conversation along similar lines. So definitely check all that stuff out. As I mentioned before, there's all kinds of great stuff coming down the line here, including a conversation with Eric J. Millar. You have Aidan Wachter. I had a really interesting conversation with Eduardo Fidencio Cano about Lucifer and all the research that he's done into the topic. And also, the next The Green Mushroom audio grimoire episode is in the works, so keep an ear peeled for that as well. So if you like the show and you're into what I'm doing here, you can support it on Patreon. If you do so, you could take a bibliomancy break with me. There aren't any like tiers or levels or whatever, so give as you will. So thank you so much to everybody who's already doing that. Your support is really, really appreciated. So thank you very much. Another way that you can support the show is by telling a friend or lover or arch nemesis about it. Ooh, I guess they're not mutually exclusive. Anyway, but word of mouth is huge. Positive reviews are also very helpful too. You can just write like good show or whatever. It doesn't have to be like a huge, you know, long thing or anything. Although I do really appreciate the very, very kind reviews that I've gotten from folks. So much love. Thank you. Okay, so as I promised, let's talk about tomatoes. Okay, so technically this, you know, the botanical name for tomato is Solanum lycopersicum. And these are in the nightshade family. So you'll hear a little bit more about that here. You might have gotten into arguments with your friends, if you're like me, or perhaps your spouse, about whether a tomato is a fruit or a vegetable. And, you know, P.S., from a botanical standpoint, it's technically a berry, which is a type of fruit. But it turns out there's actually a pretty interesting reason for all this confusion around this particular one. Okay, so in 1887, the U.S. imposed tariff laws that put a 10% duty on vegetables, but not on fruit. And a tomato importer named John Nix sued the tax collector for the Port of New York, arguing that tomatoes, since they were really fruits, should be exempt from the tax. The botanical claim was not in dispute. Like, everybody was like, yeah, we know, but technically they're, like, not used that way. So, in a triumph of ordinary language over scholarly language, the highest court in the land ruled in 1893 that the tomato was a vegetable and therefore subject to the tariff. So, in this decision, Justice Gray wrote, "Botanically speaking, tomatoes are fruits of a vine, just as are cucumbers, squashes, beans, and peas. But in the common language of the people, all these are vegetables, which, whether eaten cooked or raw, are usually served at dinner, in with or after the soup, fish, or meats, which constitute the principal part of the repast, and not, like fruits generally, as dessert." So there you go. There is a legal definition of a vegetable for you, in case you weren't satisfied with the botanical one. Tomatoes are obviously super popular. I especially love some of the cool heirloom varieties, but for a while people, well, at least some people, thought that they were poisonous. Okay, this is kind of funny. So during colonial times in America, the colonists thought that the tomatoes were super dangerous. Folklore had it that if you ate one, its poison would turn your blood into acid. They grew them purely for decoration, though. I love the idea of, like, thinking that this shit's, like, super dangerous, like, it'll turn your blood to- But it looks kind of pretty, so we'll still grow it. Actually, a lot of ornamental plants that we grow are incredibly toxic, just a side note. Anyway, the people who were native to South and Central America, of course, where this plant is native to, knew that they were edible, and they had been cultivating them for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's kind of amusing to think that the tomato, which most of us associate with, like, Italian food and stuff, actually evolved on a completely different continent in a different hemisphere. So it's kind of a new arrival to Italy. We'll get back to that in a second, though. So why did tomatoes have such a bad reputation early on in U.S. history? The answer lies both in appearance and in name. So for starters, the close resemblance of a tomato to the deadly nightshade, like, so close that the two were occasionally mistaken for each other, definitely hurt the tomato's reputation. Because of that resemblance, many botanists recognize the relationship of tomatoes to the Solanaceae family, which is the nightshade family. And they were actually placed, I think, at first in the Solanum genus, which is, like, the straight-up nightshade genus. So they were later reclassified into a new grouping within Solanaceae, that's the family level. So this was the classification Lycopersicum, which means wolf peach. So this is like a Greek version of a botanical name. This is how botanical naming works, is like you take the word and you turn it into Latin or Greek to give it its fancy botanical name. So this was something that they had taken from the German, it's thought here, Wolfsprich, which also translates into English as wolf peach. So exactly how old this word was and how common, it's hard to ascertain. Like many quote facts in tomato history, there's a lot of confusion and fog, and many sources remain either silent or contradictory on numerous points of interest, it says here in my notes, which I should note are from Planet Natural. Okay, so pressing on here. So, all right, no matter where it came from, this often repeated version of the name tomato, wolf peach, Wolfsprich, referred to the tomato's round shape, reminiscent of a peach, which we also know looks like a butt, while the wolf modifier is derived from the Germanic folk belief that werewolves could be called up using either members of the Solanaceae or nightshade family, like nightshade or wolfsbane. So many members of this family are indeed poisonous or hallucinogenic, or both. The family also contains many edible popular members, such as potatoes and chili peppers, tomatillos, and eggplants, and much more, actually. It's a cool family. Okay, cool. Thanks, Planet Natural, for that. So perhaps because they are or can be shaped like butts, they can be shaped a lot of different ways, as we all know that, tomatoes were once considered a powerful aphrodisiac and were sometimes associated with the temptation of Eve in the Garden of Eden. This is from Wikipedia. Their French name, Pomme d'Amour, or Apple of Love, and the Spanish name, Palma Amoris, reflect this. Hungarians called it Paradis Apfel, Apple of Paradise. The Greeks called it Pomodora, or Golden Apple. and associated with the golden apples of Hera. So I have a question for you, friends. Riddle me this. I'm curious if this is a New World plant that was not introduced into Europe until long, long after ancient Greeks was like a thing anymore. I'm super curious about what the fuck Wikipedia is talking about here. But I think this is a really good example of why you should think critically about the information that you find in sources, occult or otherwise, including this podcast. But I also think it's interesting, too, that just because it might not be historically accurate, that doesn't mean it's magically useful, right? If it's magically useful for you to think about the ancient Greeks fucking around with tomatoes, go for it. I'm not here to stop you from doing that. I just think this is fucking funny. So yes. Here we go, pressing on. Tomatoes are associated with a Venus and Aphrodite and Hera. This plant is feminine in nature. The presence of a tomato can help protect from negative influences. Putting one on the windowsill will prevent evil from entering the house. Eating the fruit, or as we know, technically legally vegetable, inspires love and passion. It's a good addition to a romantic dinner and also good to eat to inspire creativity. Although the flavor is completely different, tomatoes can be used in place of apples in many magic spells. They can also be used in place of other members of the nightshade family. Alright, fuck yeah, thanks to Wikipedia and Planet Natural for all that. The mention of golden apples in the context of this, I don't know, historically dubious entry here in Wikipedia, which is a totally scholarly source, kind of makes me think of somebody else who's associated with golden apples, or maybe just one golden apple, rather. I'm guessing that there are probably a lot more cool and, I don't know, real folklore associated with the tomato, like especially from cultures who lived where the plant actually grew historically. So I couldn't really find much of that for this one, but if you know, and if you do magic using tomatoes, I would love to fucking hear about it. Please share your thoughts with me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com, or you can find me on Instagram at luxoccultpod. All right, so moving on to some more Valentine's Day themed stuff. I want to share like a short passage from Austin Osman Spare with y'all. This is some of his more lucid writing, I would say. It's not going to be as confusing as some of the other stuff you might have heard me share in the past if you're a regular listener. But I think this one is a really cool example because it has to do with this idea of like transforming things, like using your perception to transform that which you find ugly into that which you find beautiful, or like just kind of freeing yourself from that dichotomy in the first place. But yes. I think that these kinds of things can be really psychologically healthy to do, can be a really good sort of like, I don't know, deconditioning or whatever, reconditioning exercise to sort of reassess that for yourself. I think there are obviously a lot of control mechanisms placed on that stuff. I mean, just look at advertising. So this idea of self-love and self-compassion and all that stuff, I think is sort of central to a lot of this. And this will come up with the passage I'll share from Aidan Wachter's book as well. So, yeah, there's some things that I do in my own practice that are sort of aimed at this idea. And, yeah, I think it's definitely been something that over the years has helped me a lot. And I don't know, just sort of helped me open up a lot of, like, space that might have been otherwise taken up by things that aren't as helpful to me. Okay, so this is from the first thing that I started the episode with, the first formula from the formula of Zosvel Thanatos. This is the first formula of the White Sabbath, as first told me by a witch, he claims. Okay, so here he goes explaining the sort of theory behind this. It's called the White Sabbath, right? Actually, there is neither a black nor a white Sabbath. The ethical criterion of all acts is whether they are antisocial or so motivated. Where two or more of a kind of equal maturity and inclination enact for consummation, then if harm they do, it is only to themselves, which I doubt, and far less harmful than the practices of those who mutilate or deny their bodies in the name of a culture or a religion. The latter are invariably prophets or progenitors of sterility, whereas the one outward tenet of witchcraft is silence to unlike others. Okay, so let me parse this out for you here just real quick. Basically what he's saying is that, like, in the time and place where this comes from, there was a lot of laws surrounding, like, you know, what people could and couldn't do with their bodies, who they couldn't, you know, sleep with and stuff. There, it was, like, straight up illegal to be a homosexual and stuff. So what he's saying here is that, like, as long as we have consenting adults, they're not going to, like, hurt anybody else with their private activities, right? And what he's talking about here with, like, the outward tenet of witchcraft is silence to unlike others. Like, I think he's probably making a reference to the witch's pyramid, which is, like, you know, to will, to dare, to remain silent, right? Okay, cool. Hopefully we were caught up there. Let's move on. So the Sabbath is an inverse reversion for self-seduction, an undoing for a divertive conation. Sex is used as the technique and medium of a magical act. There is not only erotic satisfaction. The sensualist is made detached and controlled until final sublimation. His whole training is submissive and obedient until, by cold amoral passion, he can transmute control and divert him or herself where desired. The witch, so engaged, is old, grotesque, worldly, and libidinously learned, and is sexually attractive as a corpse. Yet she becomes the entire vehicle of consummation. This is necessary to transmute the personal aesthetic culture. Perversion is used only to overcome moral prejudices or conformity. The mind and desire must become immoral, focused and made entirely acceptive, so that the life force is free of inhibitions prior to the control. Thus, the Sabbath becomes a deliberate sex orgy for the purpose of materialization, the great reality of as-if wishful thinking. Sex is fully exploited. He who injures none, himself does not injure. Finally, a culturally accepted criterion has destroyed more effective affinity than any other belief. But he who transmutes the ugly into a new aesthetic has something beyond fear. For the ethical pragmatist, I can assert that this formula has never harmed me. For the contrary, by improved health and self-control, it has made me tolerant, understanding, and compassionate. It inspires and promises more than probability as possible, and it is the only thing that has made reality magical and the magical reality. Pleasure is in us and around us. Now I beckon, and it cometh unto me. All right, fuck yes. To my way of thinking, like, there's a lot of really good info in that short passage about what you can get out of a sex magic practice in terms of how it can help you to, I don't know, kind of, like, unravel some of the designs that have been, you know, drawn on you in terms of how we've been programmed and how we've been, you know, socialized. And I think that I would say that this is a sort of, like, process that goes, like, hand in hand. Like, it's a sort of, like, feedback loop, like a two-way street. Like, in order to have a more effective sex magic practice, this is something that you sort of need to do anyway. And so it's this sort of, like, cycle of, you know, freeing yourself of these constraints to be more effective in the world and in your sex magic practice. It's sort of like this, as I said, feedback loop. So hopefully that makes sense. So this brings me to the sort of, like, I don't know, alchemical or transformative work or whatever you want to call it that I'm attempting with my weird erotic art project, this sound magic album thing, which I still haven't come up with a title for. I guess I should probably work on that. It seemed fitting to talk about it here in this Valentine's Day episode, though. So I was thinking about what I should say about it, and then I remembered that I had written a little synopsis a bit ago, so I will share an abbreviated version of that. And I think at the end of the episode, I will play a sample. Okay, so here's what I wrote about it. So this project began in October of 2021 as a means of furthering the work I started with my previous project, Gratis Animus. I'm hoping that this album reflects some of the progress that I was able to make with my last. The goal is for it to be, on average, bolder and more playful than my previous work, while still being honest about where I was at emotionally when I began it. I would like for this project to be an opportunity for me to address some long-standing anxieties and to be a means of celebrating things about myself which I have previously suppressed or kept hidden. As is the case with most creative endeavors, one can only hope it will turn out in a certain way. It's good to remember that what results from such undertakings can be surprising deviations from whatever standard was originally set in place. Wherever this work takes me, it is both my suspicion and my hope that I will be transformed by it in some way. Okay, word. So yeah, so far it has gone pretty good and it has been interesting. And I have had some pretty sort of surprising things happen with it. I would say it's definitely been really helpful in allowing me to expand my comfort zone, which is what I set out to do, right? It's also given me the opportunity to try a more, like, I don't know, ambitious, maybe would be the right word, like, series of experiments. And I think when you find a vehicle that can, like, let you do something like that, it's certainly worth climbing in and seeing where that fucker might take you. So yes, looking forward to working more on that. So Spare talks about this idea of, like, you know, the Sabbath of the Witch and, you know, all of that. And I think that that dovetails really nicely into a passage that I would like to share with you from Aidan Wachter's new book, Changeling, A Book of Qualities. It's a really cool book. And one of the things that I liked a lot about it was that it was very welcoming to folks that might be coming from a slightly different perspective, maybe neurodivergent or whatever. So I think it was really nice to see something like that that was very accepting of that and celebrating of these differences. And so yeah, it's cool stuff. Okay. Thematically appropriate quality. This is quality 55. A witch knows love. A witch loves themselves and works to accept their weaknesses, their failures, their frailties, and the skills they lack. It is from this place of self-love that they work towards their aspirations. From this place of self-love and the self-care that comes from it, they see that others are also worth loving, also worth caring for. While they may not be of the mind that says, love is all there is, they aspire to love fully, freely, and with open eyes, not ignoring the faults, weaknesses, or ill actions of self or others, but seeing the true spirit of self and other in spite of those things, often even exposed and amplified by them. In coming from this place of love, a witch is also compassionate. They are caring, and they see that everyone struggles, and they are open enough to feel for this state. They have boundaries, so they aren't in a constant state of ruin because of the pain of others, and they don't ignore or overlook abuse that transgresses against themselves or others. They know love means that they must also be compassionate with themselves. They know that they suffer, and that suffering, illness, loss, and death are part of life. They accept that sometimes they will handle these things more gracefully, sometimes less so. They accept that grief and sadness take many forms, and that they often come in strange waves and cycles. They are therefore kind with themselves and others. As they ride those waves and they understand that sometimes everyone gets caught up in the churn. They lend a hand if they are able to help those and get them caught up to the shore, but they don't minimize or try to free them from their experience. If magic is an act of love, and it often is, then the being made of such magic is a being that must know love. In love is great power, great wisdom, and great strength. All right, fuck yeah.
Happy Valentine's Day or Lupercalia or whatever. I just wanted to reiterate once more to anybody out there who might be feeling like they are different or other or whatever. This can be a lonely path, but you're not alone, no matter how much it might feel like that sometimes. And if you haven't already figured this out or you need a reminder, you already have the power within yourself to make positive changes in your life. Regardless of how that might look in your situation. You don't need to buy anything from anybody or have anyone else give you permission to step into your own power and agency. It all starts with the choice that you make within yourself to take full responsibility for your shit. I feel like that saying from Spider-Man about power and responsibility, like, works both ways, actually. And, okay, continuing on, things might be pretty rough right now. It's been a fucked up couple of years for all of us, and who knows what's coming next, right? But things will get better. I tell myself this all the time. Things will get better, because we're gonna fucking make them that way. Alright, I'm gonna say the Green Mushroom Project statement of resistance. Aidan Wachter calls it the spell of resistance, which is also dope, Call it whatever you like, though. Just remember to resist. Resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. Resist by maintaining love of the self. Resist by maintaining fierce loyalty to love and pleasure. Resist with acts of radical kindness. Focus on the path to better times. All right, fuck yeah. Stay strong and stay fucking curious. I'm gonna leave you with a track from my as of yet unnamed album. And this track also is not titled yet, so lots of naming to do. So one of the reasons that I chose this particular bit to share with you all is that it features a poem which I read on the show before, and I thought it might be fun to just sort of like show the evolution of how this has been happening. So yes. Also, I should mention that this track is not safe for work, so please do not listen to it if that might be uncomfortable for you for any reason, or if you do not want to hear a pretty flagrant display of female pleasure. I hope you enjoy it if you choose to listen to it. All right, cheers and much love. Stay strong and stay fucking curious. I'm getting higher. Occam's scalpel slid through the breast, exposing a quivering sparrow. Aves and pectoris, a lark, a mockingbird. They trilled into ink and ink when I took a sword. Grasping desperately for Ariadne's thread, I found it coiled inside me like so many serpents. Its syllogisms are simple, and with these entrails I'll divine a path from this maze. For freedom, make dental amputations to foot or paw, blazing pain's path to cauterize wounds, the hollow of this loss. On the shores of oblivion, I shall know the redemption of my journey. Igne natura, I will walk through fire, reinventar integra, until I am dancing.
Lux Occult is a part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. To hear more great independent productions like the one you just listened to, visit our catalog at tgmpodcastnetwork.com.
What scares you?
Ghosts? Aliens?
Monsters?
The occult? Conspiracies?
Some of you like to be scared, and unearthing paranormalcy is for you.
Some of you try everything you can to avoid it. Unearthing paranormalcy is for you.
We take the topics that scare some, and we dig in to find the source, then present the history to make the paranormal a little more normal.
We also throw in a bit of comedy to shed a light on some of the darkness in the world.
So whether you're scared of bumps in the night, what's inside your own mind, or strange lights in the sky, we cover it all.
We dig in and present all that we find and try to come up with some logical
and not so logical
reasons for the high strangeness happenings.
Sometimes we are scared of the things we don't understand. And the more we understand, the less we fear.
So find us, Unearthing Paranormalcy, on your favorite podcast app. And join us on Facebook, Instagram, and Discord at UMP Normalcy. And until next time,
keep digging.
Hello, Strange Seeds. This is the Primordia Podcast, your source for strange. I'm your host, Britt. Join me semi-weekly as we pull off our flesh suits and dive into the primordial waters of the mystical and magical, the downright freaky, the strange and bizarre, unsettling synchronicities, and the truly terrifying. We'll leave each episode with a list of reading recommendations if you feel so inclined to research further the topics we discuss, which I encourage you to do. Connect with a growing community of eclectic minds who strive to leave a more positive, compassionate imprint on this weird world we live in. So dive on in with us, and don't be scared. The water's fine.